Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Existence of God, Part 3. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
We have an outline that we're going through on the contingency argument for God's existence. We've been looking at premise one: every existing thing has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. And we saw that typically the atheist will want to deny this first premise and say that the universe is an exception to this principle, that the universe just exists inexplicably without any explanation of its existence. And I argued that that move is arbitrary. Indeed, it commits what one person has called the taxicab fallacy of thinking that you can just dismiss the causal principle like a hack when you arrive at your desired destination. On the contrary, this principle, I think, would apply to anything that exists, and we do not say that it fails to apply to God. As theists, we don't make him an exception to the principle. On the contrary, we would say that God does exist by a necessity of his own nature. So the atheist really is being quite arbitrary when he applies this principle everywhere else in life but tries to exempt the universe. Now, that brings us to today. Some atheists do try to justify making the universe an exception to premise one. Sometimes they'll say it's impossible for the universe to have an explanation of its existence. Well, why is that, you might ask? Well, basically, they reason as follows. An explanation of the universe would have to be a prior state of affairs in which nothing exists. Since the universe is just everything there is, if there's an explanation of the universe, it would have to be in a prior state of affairs in which the universe did not yet exist. But that would just be nothingness. And nothingness can't explain anything, and therefore the universe cannot have an explanation of its existence. The universe must exist just inexplicably. Well, I hope you can see that that line of reasoning is just obviously fallacious. It's circular. It assumes that the universe is all there is, so that in the absence of the universe, there would be nothing. That assumes that the universe is everything. In other words, it assumes atheism is true. So the atheist is arguing in a circle here, begging the question in assuming that in the absence of the universe, there would be nothingness. By contrast, Leibniz would agree that the explanation of the universe must be in some sort of prior state of affairs, not chronologically prior, but explanatorily prior. There would have to be some prior state of affairs in which the universe did not yet exist. But that state of affairs would not be nothingness. It would be God and his will, and these would furnish the explanation of why the universe exists. So that attempt to justify the universe as an exception to premise one, I think, is simply question-begging or circular. So in conclusion, with regard to the first premise, I think this premise is certainly more plausibly true than its opposite. It's more plausibly true than false. Think of the illustration that Richard Taylor gives that I recounted before of finding the ball in the woods. It would obviously need an explanation of why it exists, and merely increasing the size of the object, even until it becomes coextensive with the universe, neither explains its existence nor removes the need of an explanation of its existence. Any comment or question then about that attempt to justify making the universe an exception to premise one, or about premise one in general? Okay, back here.
You probably explained this and I missed it. I apologize. But why doesn't the necessity of its own nature explain the universe for someone who wants to take this premise and just simply say it's necessary, otherwise there'd be nothing?
We'll get to that point later on, probably next week. But most atheists don't take that tack. By far and away, almost everybody who's an atheist will simply say the universe is a brute fact. It has no explanation for why it exists. It just exists. But you're right. They could take that tack, and we'll have to look at that in a moment. Okay, any other question about what we've said so far? Yes, Taiwan? Back here.
When God created the world in the beginning, there was water. Water was not part of his creative process. The spirit hovered over water. So what does that, how do you explain that?
I think that, in fact, the water is part of the creation. In verse 1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is his creation of the universe. In ancient Hebrew, there is no word for the universe. When the ancient Hebrew wanted to express the universe, he would use this idiom, the heavens and the earth. That meant everything there was. So that's what God creates in the beginning. Then in verse 2, the focus suddenly narrows dramatically. And it says, and the earth was without form and void. And then what is described is how God turns the earth into a habitable place. But that's already been created in verse 1. Similarly, in Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom, personified as a woman, says, when there were no depths, that's mentioned in Genesis, the spirit hovering over the depths. In Proverbs, when there were no depths, wisdom says, I was there with God in the beginning. So God and his wisdom precedes the existence of any sort of physical reality on earth or in the heavens. Yes?
Age-old question. So when my atheist friend says, well, who created God or how was God created? I have no answer.
Well, now, okay, look at premise one, Bill. And how would you answer that question based on premise one? Do you have an outline?
He's always been there and always will. Alpha
well,
and Omega.
That's fine. That's fine. But look at premise one. Which alternative would you pick for an explanation of God's existence?
I don't have one in front of me.
Oh, okay. Well, that's your problem. If you would look at premise one,
I've got a creative premise.
Look at premise one, you will see the obvious answer to the question, what created God? It says every existing thing has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. God cannot have an external cause. Even atheists admit that, because that would be something greater than God, which is impossible. That thing would be God. So God, if he exists, exists by a necessity of his own nature. He has no cause. There is no external cause. So the question, once you understand the premise, is very easy to answer. Yes, Steve?
Yeah, going back to the other question about the void without form, isn't that idiom used somewhere else to describe a destruction in the Old Testament?
Yeah, this tohu wabohu. Right. It doesn't mean chaos in the sense of a Greek sense of chaos. It just means an uninhabitable waste.
And a lot of scholars attribute there's a long period of time between God created the heavens and the earth until he looks on that.
Yes, we talked about that in our discussion of doctrine of creation. So I don't want to get off on a tangent there. You can look at the podcast for that portion of the course, and we'll be coming back again to that too in the future. But that's quite correct. It doesn't mean a kind of chaotic, swirling realm of nothingness. It just means an uninhabitable waste. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just commenting on the previous question about God's existence. The way I've explained it to people is that God can exist in and of himself because he has a mind. The universe, however, doesn't have a mind of its own. It doesn't have a creative power. So that's why God is more reasonably the terminal being, the beginning.
Yeah, I don't feel comfortable with saying that, Dennis, because having a mind doesn't mean you exist by a necessity of your own nature. I mean, we have minds, and yet we also have external causes. And we shouldn't think of God as a product of his own creative power either. This is not, notice it does not say every existing thing has an explanation, either an external cause or it's a self-cause. I think the idea of being a self-cause is a contradiction. It's not that God created himself, that he somehow used his creative power to bring himself into being. He would have to be explanatorily prior to himself. I mean, that really would be a problem. Rather, the idea is simply he exists necessarily in the way that if they exist, numbers and other mathematical objects exist. Dennis says, the universe could not have created God, but God could have created the universe. And clearly that's right. I think there's clearly an asymmetrical situation there that makes it much more plausible to think of God as the cause. That's right. Okay, another question. Where is our mic? Okay, right here. Good.
Just real quick, with the two explanations for existence, either the own nature or the external cause, so is it safe to say that the necessity of its own nature only applies to God, and then everything else is an external cause?
Well, in my opinion, as a Christian, I think it only applies to God.
Right.
But historically, philosophers have identified many different sorts of necessary beings. I mentioned numbers, for example, are a classic case. Plato and other followers of Plato think that numbers exist necessarily, or other mathematical objects like sets and functions and geometrical figures and other things, propositions and properties. There are all kinds of things that historically different philosophers have identified as existing by a necessity of their own nature. Now, out of theological convictions, I think that in fact only God exists necessarily. But that's a theological conviction that doesn't enter the argument yet at this point. Here we're having an open mind and entertaining the possibility there could be many such things. I don't want to go back to someone who's already asked a question. So, all right, any other comments on premise one?
I'm sorry. I'm always apprehensive about asking you questions because you're so incisive. You nail me on these things.
Well, no, I don't. I want to help you. Go ahead.
But was it Friedrich Nietzsche that wrote Being and Nothingness? And he tried to define those characteristics of what nothingness would have existed like. It was a real abstruse thing. I read it when I was a kid and didn't quite understand it. But
That was Sartre, an existentialist. And we're not using nothingness here when I talk about nothing in a sort of existential sense of despair or meaninglessness and things like that. We're just meaning here the absence of anything that exists.
The physical
phenomena. So it's the common sense, ordinary word in which we say nothing. We mean there isn't anything.
Yeah, as a kid, it's dangerous to read some of those things because it kind of confuses you a little
bit. It's very confusing when people like Heidegger says the nothing's itself and so forth. Yeah, you have to be very careful in choosing your guides in philosophy, I think. Okay, any other question about this first premise and its defense? Okay, Bob?
Just comment to the people, if you would, how important it is now with the rise of Eastern mysticism and Eastern thought and pantheism, how they attach the necessity of God to the actual physical universe, that he is all, in fact, and how important it is that we really understand this. If somebody doesn't, they really get this, because that is the growing belief system that's entering the Western world right now.
Yes, Bob is right in pointing out that in pantheistic religions like Hinduism, Taoism, certain forms of Buddhism, there's an identity between God and the universe, so that the universe takes on the attributes of God. And certainly as Christians, we need to have good reasons why we think that God is distinct from the world and its creator rather than identical with the world. And these arguments, as you'll see as they unfold, will do that for you. If these arguments are valid, they will narrow down the range of the world's religions to the great monotheistic traditions like Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, or deism perhaps. But they will exclude these pantheistic religions. All right, one more question, and then we want to go to the second premise.
Thank you. You spoke a minute ago about numbers and functions and laws, so to speak. If these were not created by God, would he not be subject to those things?
I think that's the problem, and that's why I said on theological grounds, I don't believe that numbers exist. So, yes, I share your concern.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to premise two then. What about the second premise? If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. Is this premise more plausibly true than false? Now, at first you might think, well, no atheist is going to agree with this, that if the universe has an explanation, the explanation is God. This is going to be a controversial premise. Well, in fact, what's really awkward for the atheist is that premise two of this argument is logically equivalent to the typical atheist response to Leibniz's argument. Now, what do I mean when I say two statements are logically equivalent. What I mean by that is that it's impossible for one of them to be true and the other one to be false. They stand or fall together. If two statements are logically equivalent, they're either both true or they're both false. But you can't have one be true and the other one false. So logically equivalent statements share the same truth value. They're either both true or they're both false. Now, with that in mind, what does the atheist almost always say in response to Leibniz's argument? Well, as we've just seen, what the atheist typically asserts is, A, let me get a marker here that writes more clearly. He asserts, if atheism is true, the universe has no explanation of its existence. The universe just exists as a brute fact. It just exists inexplicably. It's just there, and that's all. If atheism is true, the universe has no explanation of its existence. And that's exactly what the atheist typically says in response to premise one. Remember, he says the universe just exists inexplicably. But this is logically equivalent to B. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, then atheism is not true. Can you see the logical equivalence of A and B? If atheism is true, the universe has no explanation. That's equivalent to saying if the universe has an explanation, then atheism is not true. They're just sort of the flip side of one another. If atheism is true, the universe has no explanation. That's equivalent to saying if the universe has an explanation, then atheism is not true. Those are logically equivalent statements. So you cannot affirm A and deny B. If you affirm A, you have to also affirm B. But B is virtually synonymous with premise two. Look at premise two, just compare them. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. It's almost synonymous with B. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, atheism is not true. That is to say, God exists. So you can't affirm A and not B. Thus, in replying to premise one, that if atheism is true, the universe has no explanation of its existence, the atheist has implicitly admitted the truth of premise two, that if the universe does have an explanation of its existence, then God exists. Any question about that defense of premise two? Yes.
Bill, I don't know if the atheists hold this, but it seems to me if they were playing a safe bet, they would just say that we haven't discovered enough, or our scientific knowledge hasn't advanced far enough to know if there's energies outside of our senses that we haven't been able to observe.
Right. That's fine. This is not a scientific argument. This is a metaphysical argument. So whatever realms of reality might exist outside of our observable universe, say it's part of a multiverse, Leibniz will simply ask the same question of the multiverse. Why does the multiverse exist? It must have an explanation of its existence, and it will either be in an external cause or in the necessity of its own nature. So the size of the universe really is quite irrelevant to this argument.
Even the nature.
Unless you want to say that it exists necessarily, which, as I say, atheists are very, very loath to say. I don't know of any atheist philosopher on the contemporary scene who thinks that the universe exists necessarily. The typical response is to say there's just no explanation. It's just there. And that, as I say, is equivalent to affirming premise two. Any other question about that defense of premise two? Do you see the logical equivalence of A and B and how B is almost synonymous with two? Yes, Joe?
Do you ever run into, I've heard this a couple of times, that it's they're not arrogant, they're being very humble by saying there's no explanation and yeah. You should be too.
Yes, yes. And that's a red herring, as I'm sure you know, Joe. Arguments don't have personalities. Arguments aren't arrogant or prideful or humble. You know, people are. The validity or the soundness of this argument, as you recall, depends on two things: the truth of the premises and whether or not it's logically valid. Does it obey the rules of logic? And apart from those two tests, these other sorts of things are just irrelevant. The question is, which premise will you deny and why, Mr. Atheist? And it seems to me that he's committed to the second premise and that his denial of the first premise is arbitrary. And so I think he's in an awkward spot. Now, let me say in addition to that, however, that I think premise two is very plausible in its own right, wholly apart from the fact that it is logically equivalent to what the atheist typically says. Think of what the universe is. It is all of space-time reality. And that would include any other multiverse hypotheses that would encompass ours. All matter and energy. So it follows that if the universe has a cause of its existence, that cause must be a non-physical, immaterial being beyond space and time. Just imagine that. If there's going to be an explanation of space, time, matter, and energy, this is going to have to be in a transcendent cause beyond space and time, and therefore immaterial and non-physical in its nature. Now, there are only two kinds of object that can fit that description. An immaterial object beyond time and space, namely either abstract objects like numbers. Numbers are immaterial, right? And they typically exist beyond time and space, are typically thought to exist timelessly and spacelessly. Numbers or other mathematical entities, or else an unembodied mind. Minds are immaterial. And a mind can be timeless if it's not changing. But abstract objects can't cause anything. The number seven has no effects whatsoever. Numbers don't stand in causal relationships. That is definitive for what it means to be an abstract object as opposed to a concrete object. An abstract object is an object that doesn't stand in any causal relationships. And therefore, the cause of the existence of the universe cannot be an abstract object. It must be a transcendent, unembodied mind, which is precisely what theists take God to be. So, as I say, premise two seems to me to be very plausible in its own right, wholly apart from what the atheist admits. Just to repeat or to capsulize what I just said, the cause of the universe would have to be beyond time and space and therefore immaterial and non-physical. There are only two kinds of things we know of that can be like that, either an abstract object or a mind. Abstract objects can't cause anything, so the cause of the universe must be a transcendent, unembodied mind. Now, I hope you begin to grasp the power of Leibniz's argument. If it is successful, it proves the existence of a necessary, uncaused, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, personal creator of the universe. Let me repeat that. If it's successful, it proves the existence of a necessary, uncaused, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, personal creator of the universe. This is not some ill-conceived flying spaghetti monster postulated to fill up our gaps in our knowledge. Rather, this is an ultra-mundane or transcendent being with many of the properties of traditional theism that we looked at in our study of the attributes of God. So this is really a mind-blowing argument if it's successful. Any comment or question then about that defense of premise two? Yeah, Bob here again. Yeah, Bob wanted me to comment about how the mind actually controls things. When you think about causation, what is the most intimate causal mechanism that you are familiar with? What is the causal process with which you have the most intimate knowledge? Is it things in the external world moving about, bumping each other as you observe them and their effects? Not really. The cause with which you are most intimately acquainted is yourself. You have volitions in your mind. You will to do something, such as to lift your arm. to take a step, to utter words. And lo and behold, those causes or those effects ensue as a result of your causal activity. You exert your will, you make an exertion of causal power, and these effects are produced. And this is an example, I think, of the mind's ability to control physical things. And in the same way that my mind exerts causal influence upon my body, God exerts immediate causal influence upon the world. He causes effects in the world in the same way that my mind causes effects in my body. Now, I am not saying that the world is the body of God. Clearly, that's not what I'm saying. The world is a creation. That's the whole argument here. It's caused by God. But God has the ability to act in the world through his mind in the same way that our minds work in our bodies. So it's a nice analogy, I think, that helps us to understand God's relation to the world. Any other comment on premise two? Oh, yes. Yeah, the characteristics that this argument leads to. A necessary, because it exists by the necessity of its own nature, uncaused, because it has no external cause, timeless, because it must be beyond time to create time, spaceless, because it must be beyond space to create space, immaterial, because it's spaceless and timeless, it can't be material, personal, because only a mind can account for the existence of the universe, an abstract object can't do it, personal, creator of the universe. So, a necessary, uncaused, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, personal creator of the universe is the implication of Leibniz's argument. Any other comment or question? Okay, Steve?
You started a little while ago. You said that only two things could be outside of you, an abstract object which can't affect, or a mind.
Yes.
Now, I'm going towards how can the mind affect since it's outside of the universe, and going towards Paul's statements, we all live and breathe within him, going to an idealistic type of, wouldn't the same argument prove that, you know, we're all, you know, God says if he withdrew his spirit, all flesh would die. We all have this because I'm making an argument. Couldn't use that argument for idealism.
Well, I don't think so. I think maybe you and I have a different understanding of idealism. It sounds to me like you're talking about some kind of panpsychism where there's some sort of psyche that permeates the world. And I think my answer to Bob's question answered your question about how could a mind which is distinct from the world exercise its causal ability in the world. It would be the same way that my mind exercises causal powers in my own body. I don't think that God needs to be in space in order to produce effects in space. And if somebody had an argument for that, I want to see it, but I've never seen a good argument for that. Seems to me that a timeless, spaceless being can exert effects such as producing the existence of a space-time world. We're about at the end of our time, so let me just say this to conclude. So I think that both of these premises are plausibly true, and given the obvious truth of premise three, that the universe exists, it therefore follows that the explanation of the universe is God. Now, what can the atheist do at this point? Well, he does have a more radical alternative open to him. He can retrace his steps, go back to premise one, withdraw his objection to premise one, and say, all right, yes, the universe does have an explanation of its existence, and that explanation is that the universe exists by a necessity of its own nature. The universe is a necessary being. So that for the atheist, the universe can serve as a sort of God substitute which exists by a necessity of its own nature. And that will be the objection that we will deal with next Sunday.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.